Very, very special guest in the building with us. Somebody who I'd known for a long time when he was making history here in Berkeley at UC Berkeley's campus when he was running for president of the ASUC and becoming the first person of color to hold that spot down. And for folks who went to Cal, he was one of the foundations for one of the political parties on that campus called CalServe. But he's gone on to do bigger and better things. And he is a guru when it comes to urban education, the author of a couple of books, including City Schools and What is the Problem with Young Black Boys. His name is Pedro Noguera. Brother, how you doing?
David D., good to see you.
And also a professor at NYU.
Yep.
Okay. You know, we've been having these conversations, and there's so much going on when you talk about education. It seems like in 2013, there's a major crossroads. That's how I see it in terms of which way it's going to go. It seems like on one side, you got forces saying privatize and just dead public education. On the other side, you're saying you see people pushing to make it more accessible and to improve the quality. And there's a lot of information that's flying back and forth, so much so that people from either side don't know where to really plant their flag. But you've been in the middle of this, especially being in New York City. If I was to ask you the state of public education, how would you break it down?
So, I mean, I think you're right that right now we're in a very kind of polarized state of affairs about the direction of public education. On the one hand, you've got the so-called new reformers who are market-based reforms, pushing things like charter schools, pushing things like performance pay for teachers. And we should add here that that's not just Gates Foundation, Broad Foundation. It's also the Obama administration that's been pushing these things. On the other hand, are people who want to try to keep and restore public education as we've known it. And I would say the unions, the teacher unions, being a major force behind that. Left in the middle are parents who just want to get a good education for their children and who also often have trouble figuring out who's who and which side is best representing their interest. And so a lot of my work has been trying to sift through some of these big divisions to figure out, okay, where does, if not truth, where does justice lie? what's in the best interest of communities, particularly disenfranchised, disadvantaged communities and children? And how do we make sure that that the education that our kids need so desperately is not sacrificed, compromised by this political battle going on?
You know, when looking at some of your work, what's been kind of, you know, I shouldn't say kind of, what's been very interesting is that it seems like you placed a scenario where teachers and the school itself has to evolve. And by that, I mean, you know, you talk about the fact that there needs to be training and there needs to be understanding of things that have nothing to do with academics, reading and writing. How do you deal with the emotional and psychological problems that people are dealing with? Can you expound upon that?
Sure.
And where are we on that path these days?
And, you know, actually, that's not a new idea. I mean, almost from the beginning schools were developed, there was a recognition that schools had to be involved not simply in the academic development of children, but also in the social development, the emotional development, ethical.
Well, did they leave that behind at some point?
Well, I think that's like what's happened is in the recent years, we've gotten so narrowly focused on raising achievement as measured by test scores that we've ignored everything else going on in the lives of children. And I think particularly for poor children, but it's true not just for poor children, affluent children as well, there are other needs that impact learning that often schools either don't have the resources for or are purposefully ignoring because that's not how they're being judged. So, for example, if a child is hungry, they will not do as well in school. Many schools don't have the resources to fully address that issue or the health issues or other issues a child will bring. And usually what will happen is the children with the greatest needs are the children who are falling further and further behind.
Right. Is it really hunger or are there other things? It seems like in many of the urban schools, it might be violence. It might be broken homes.
Right. No. But I do want to say hunger is real right now, especially we have, 22% of children in America are in poverty. So hunger and the lack of good nutritional food is a real issue for many families. But aside from that, like you said, safety is a huge issue. We have lots of kids who getting to and from school every day is a major challenge. And so is whether or not their health needs are being met. We have lots of kids coming to school with asthma or who need eyeglasses. If you can't see, it's hard to read, right? So their basic needs, housing is an educational issue. If you don't have a stable place to live and sleep at night, you won't get your homework done and you may miss a lot of days of school.
Now, when you rattled some of that off, people that are listening, I think they hear that so much that it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. We'll start with the assertion that getting to and from school is difficult. Can we really just kind of paint a picture for folks so that they honestly understand what that really means? Because we hear that, but I don't think it clicks for a lot of folks.
Yeah. For example, there are neighborhoods in East Oakland and many parts of Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, where if you, especially when you enter middle school, if you're not in a gang, you are vulnerable, right? Getting to and from school, riding that bus every day means you take a risk because someone may prey upon you and may make it difficult for you to get to school. Chicago, we talked about Newtown, the tragedy in Newtown. Chicago lost over 100 children under the age of 18 to gun violence last year. So the threat of violence is an everyday reality for many of our children. It goes well beyond bullying. It goes to the reality that in many of our communities, there's a lack of safety. That impacts children to a greater degree than it does adults.
But the response to that over the years has been zero tolerance policies. If you even sneeze or look at somebody wrong, they're real quick to expel you. And so then we have this other phenomenon of the disproportionate amount of black kids in particular being expelled and sent home. I mean, the most recent example is, she wasn't being violent, but, Kiara Wilmot out in Florida where her science experiment went wrong. But it's just indicative of that sort of thing. But I wanted to find out, with that response, it seems like that's going too much in the other direction, or maybe you feel differently. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you mentioned earlier about a lot of what we're dealing with is market-based. So is there any sort of market-based solution that is being employed when we're dealing with the discipline and safety of kids? Are they looking back and saying, we can have a windfall if we move in this direction versus the other?
Yeah, I think what's happened, and we've seen it in many places, schools have developed, many schools, a very punitive culture, right? So that under zero tolerance, if a child commits even a minor infraction, they can be removed from school. They can be even arrested in school for a fight or for really in New York City. You have kids being arrested and fined in school all the time, missing days of school because of really minor offenses, cutting class, riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, et cetera. And so part of what's going on is schools realize that if you can get rid of certain kids, particularly kids who are not doing well academically, it will make your scores go up. So what ends up happening is then you end up with kids out on the streets or in the criminal justice system. And this is why many of us have been talking about a school-to-prison pipeline, because this punitive culture within schools is literally pushing kids out onto the streets where they are much more likely to engage in delinquency or to be victimized.
Who's the main pushers of this punitive culture? Is it the teachers? Is it the teachers' union? Is it administration? What's really driving it?
I would say it's a combination of things. You can't just say it's just one thing. It starts at the policy level with zero tolerance policies, as you said, and then you work into the districts. And unless there is a deliberate effort made to say we will not address discipline in this way, we're going to take a different approach. I want to applaud Oakland for trying to implement a restorative justice program, which is, I think, a more thoughtful way of addressing discipline problems. Because let's also be clear, we want our schools to be safe. Right. We want our schools to be orderly. We want our kids to obey the authorities, the teachers, right?
Right.
And so you can't just have chaos in schools and disorder. Where you have that, you also have kids staying away because they feel vulnerable. But you need to understand that safety and order are a product of relationships, not of security systems or metal detectors or armed guards.
Keyword, relationships.
That's right.
I think that goes out the window. If you're just tuning in, we have Pedro Noguera, educator, scholar. He's sitting in the building with us as we continue our conversations on education. You know, you get to lecture and speak at a lot of places. People turn to you and seek advice and guidance from the research that you've done, the extensive research and your understanding of things. If we were to make Pedro Noguera the chancellor of a school system, you know, what would be like the three or four steps that you would immediately take that would move things in the right direction? And the second part to that question, where can we look to right now to see where things are working?
Okay, well, fair questions. And I assume by chance you must mean Secretary of Education.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say that there are several things we could do. One is that we should be learning from models of success that are out there. I can name several schools throughout the country that are doing an excellent job working with English language learners, recent immigrants, homeless children, kids in foster care, model programs that are serving all kinds of learners. And what disturbs me is that we don't give educators a chance to see these schools.
Really?
And to see how they manage to create an environment where kids are successful. And here's the good thing. It's not about the money. Right. People say, oh, well, if we don't have the money, we can't do it. No, it's not about the money. Of course, you need money. You need adequate resources. But most of all, what you need is a sense of community. You need educators who are working together in teams. I can tell you a school like Brockton High School, Massachusetts, 4,100 students, bigger than Berkeley High School, far more successful at educating children of color than Berkeley High School.
And Berkeley High School is considered the model.
A third of the graduates of Brockton High School, that's a third of the students who are one-third African-American, one-third Latino, one-third low-income white, end up with four-year scholarships funded by the state of Massachusetts to any school they go to, any public university. So there are models like
these. So what are they doing there?
What they're doing is they've created a culture of learning. They focus a lot on literacy, because many of the kids come into high school reading at a below high school level, even at an elementary level. So every teacher emphasizes literacy, but they also focus on really building strong relationships with students. Students respond well to caring adults. They respond well to guidance, and that's what they really do. So, you know, many people say, well, that's a very large school. It's the largest school in Massachusetts,
right?
But it's the only urban high school in Massachusetts that gets an A-level rating by the state. So right. I could point to other examples
Let's go to Brockton. You know, when we talk about relationship, what does that really look like?
What it looks like is when a student comes in, we take time to orient that student. We take time to make sure that student's connected to a teacher, a counselor, a mentor, that we take time to build a sense of community with their peers, right, so that they know the other students, and that we deliberately work in groups, for example, in the classroom, so that students are learning from each other. These are things, again, these are not novel ideas.
And it doesn't cost money.
It doesn't cost money either.
Right.
But what it does is it creates a safer atmosphere, because now people realize they're a member of a community. They're not just there on their own.
So, you know, this whole thing about community, this seems to run counter to some of the conversations that we've had before, and not in terms of solutions. I think everybody we've had on would agree that community is important. But we were talking to some teachers last week, and they were talking about these new type of dictates where every minute is accounted for. Like, you know, you have to literally mark down, what did you do at 10 after, 5 after? And, you know, there is no time to do groups. There is no time to develop relationships. All you got to do is hit these thresholds, or you have a problem.
Yeah. No, I mean, policy is
such a big—
What
is it called? Teacher-proof. Making a teacher-proof.
That's right. Making a teacher-proof, highly scripted curriculum. Now, the other side of it is, I've gone to many schools where there's a lot of wasted time, where there's no instruction, right? Kids are just sitting around. So you need a balance in between. And the balance is, you want to make sure that teachers are working together and checking each other, holding each other accountable for really teaching kids, looking at evidence of student learning together, right? So we don't want to go. The policymakers have taken it too far. They create principals now to come and police classrooms to make sure the teacher's on the right page. That, to me, undermines the ability of the teacher to reach students and really drive some of the best teachers out of the profession. But what you do want is a sense of internal accountability, where teachers do feel accountable to each other, accountable to the students they serve, and the parents they serve.
You mentioned literacy. What does that really look like? Are we talking about reading popular books, or do they go back to the classics, or their whole new methodology that we haven't even thought of?
Well, literacy, I think, is an evolving concept as well. I mean, of course, it is about reading, writing, mastering those skills, which is still essential, but increasingly it's about being literate and how do you engage the media, right? So that, you know, you're not a passive recipient of what you watch on television or on the internet. You know how to critically analyze information and seek out information on your own.
Okay.
Because now, think about it, the average child today has access to so much information on the web. And so you want children who know how to navigate that information, but also how to critically take it in and also know what to keep out, to filter it.
Right.
And so all that I would call part of literacy, an evolving sense of literacy in a literate person today.
Now, when I went to, when I was in elementary school in the Bronx, you know, one of the things that was part of our homework assignment was we had to read a story from the New York Times every day and talk about it in class. We're talking about fifth and sixth grade. They don't do that anymore. And it seems like when people have tried to move in that direction, all of a sudden it becomes highly politicized. So now you have somebody going, well, why are they reading the New York Times when it's a liberal paper, or why are you reading this? And so that comes into question. Is that one of the reasons why we're not having that, or did they just abandon it because it was too difficult, or what?
No, I mean, I think it's a lot of variation. There are teachers I know who have kids still reading the New York Times and more, you know, and where reading is really encouraged and a love of reading is developed in children. At the same time, there are a lot of schools where that's not being encouraged, and they're focusing too much on test preparation and not enough on really developing a strong grounding in literacy in their children.
Right.
But I would say that, and this is one of the reasons why the administration's pushed this idea of the Common Core curriculum and standards.
What's the Common Core?
It's the idea that that every child, regardless of what state they live in or what school district they live in, should be exposed to a very similar curriculum.
Okay.
So it's really an equity impulse behind it, right? So that you want to make sure kids in Mississippi are learning the same things as kids in New York or kids in Massachusetts, which
right.
is not happening right now.
Okay.
At the same time, for that to work, and the way it's been conceived is to encourage critical thinking and all the kinds of higher order thinking skills that I think we would all like to see children develop. But if teachers are not trained and prepared to teach that curriculum,
right.
you're going to see a lot of problems. And that's what we're seeing right now in several states.
And so we have to have a lot of teacher development.
Teacher development, you know, teaching is intellectual work.
Right.
You don't graduate from school a master teacher. You become a master teacher in school working with children, which means you have to commit yourself as a teacher to ongoing learning
right.
so that your practice at your craft as a teacher improves over time. You need to observe other teachers. You need a chance to continue to study. You need a chance to learn from and reflect upon your work.
Right.
All those things help so that over time you get better and better as a teacher.
You know, when you mention relationship, the criticism that has often been levied on teachers has been the white teacher in the inner city school that just doesn't really want to be there. They're scared of the kids, yada, yada, yada. And the end result is, you know, whether or not that's an accurate depiction or not, that's a perception that has been put out there, is that that they don't relate to the kids that are there. You know, Miss Sally in the suburbs is dealing with, you know, Johnny from the hood, and there's not that connection. And if there's not that connection, then you don't have that relationship. But are there best practices for anybody
sure.
to come in there to really start honing that type of relationship environment that you talked about, whether they're from the burbs or from the hood?
Well, the good news is kids are much less prejudiced than adults are. Kids will learn from any caring adult. If they know that adult is genuine, cares about them, doesn't matter what color or gender or sexual orientation that person is, they will respond well to a caring adult. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that the adult has to be able to be conscious of their own biases and has to be able to transcend some of those barriers that might exist between them and their students. So there are lots of examples I can name right now of teachers who come from a very different environment than their students, but are very successful at building relationships and at teaching them effectively. And right. it's because they themselves understand it's not the student's job to do that work. It's their job as the professional.
Right.
So, but there are also lots of schools where the gap between teachers and students is great, where they don't relate, where the kids are tuned out, not motivated, not engaged, and the students, the teachers don't know what to do about it. But let's also be clear, there are black teachers who have that problem with black students.
Right.
You know, and so you can't say it's that just having the same racial background and voila, and it's magic, and suddenly good teaching
happens.
So
it's a very
happens.
Purposeful relationship.
That's right. That's right.
We've been talking with Pedro Noguera. I asked him for four examples. He gave us two. What we're going to do is we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to see what happens, what his other responses are, if he's the superintendent of schools. We'll be right back.
A boy is born in Hard Time, Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city. His father works some days for 14 hours, and you can bet he barely makes a dollar. His mother goes scrub the floors for many, and you best believe she hardly gets a penny. Living just enough for the city.
Yeah, Davey D, hanging out with you. Talking about education in the building with us is somebody who is a giant among giants in the field of education, Pedro Noguera, Cal Berkeley grad. You did your upper grad in Cal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I got my PhD.
That's right,
Berkeley.
That's when I remember. You know, what do you think just in terms of just, you know, not to get too sidetracked, but, you know, when we were at Cal, you know, it was like $200 a semester, you know, and I tell people that and they get mad. They go, really? It's like $15,000 a year. Right. I mean, what's your take on seeing schools like that all of a sudden become out of reach financially? And,
sure.
and even if people do get these loans, they're saddled with debt, you know, for a lifetime. I teach over at State and I'm seeing kids $30,000, $40,000 by the third year. I feel bad for them. Like,
oh, it's terrible.
What are they going to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad what's happened in California. When I came here in 1981, community colleges were free.
Yeah.
Cal was not 200. It was 700 a semester, but it was
well,
still.
I paid 200.
You paid 200. You got a better deal than me. But it was the best deal in town.
Right.
And it was, you know, here you have one of the top public universities in the world, completely accessible. There was also a real commitment to diversity. I remember when Mike Heyman was chancellor and Cheng Ling Tien, the motto of Berkeley was excellence in diversity.
Right.
Now to see it's become increasingly inaccessible. If you're not an athlete, very hard to get in as a Black or Latino student. This public resource has become inaccessible to vast segments of the public. At the same time, you can't really blame the university. It's really the state of California, because less than 10% of the UC budget now comes from the state of California. So we're watching the privatization of the university system, and that's a big part of it.
How important is it for us to really recognize that oftentimes when we have this conversation and we're looking at kids of color that are on the short end of the stick, and we have the boogeyman of the Tea Party or the far right, but when you come to California, a solid blue state, that's not the Tea Party running up into California doing that. These are the Democrats.
That's
These are
right.
the people who come to our community, speak at our churches, who we're encouraged to vote for and support
right.
that's behind us. I
sure.
call them corporate Democrats. How do we make sense of that? You know, when we have popular figures come into our community and say, get behind this person, and their politics when it comes to education is draconian at least.
Well, I'll give Jerry Brown a little credit, because he's just come up with a proposal to actually put more resources into schools serving the most disadvantaged students. So I think they're trying, and I know they passed a proposition to bring more funds into education, which I think will help. But, you know, the real problem in California is that California does not tax the major corporations at a level they should be. How could California be home to Hollywood, to Google, to Apple, and still be broke? It makes no sense. These are some of the wealthiest corporations in the world that are not paying taxes of a fair share to the state of California. And that's the big problem. California is not a poor state.
Right.
California is not Mississippi. California is a rich state that is cheap. It is cheap in terms of supporting and investing in its children and its infrastructure.
Is it really just that, or is it because, you know, the word up on when I'm at the campus is they feel like they are people that really want to privatize, you know, this entire school system, you know, from the community colleges on up. And so let's deliberately starve it and move it into this direction. And also you start to hear conversation about corporate partnership and all that, which says to me it's like it's no longer about education. It's about job training, which, you know, I don't know if that's always the best way.
Right, right. No, I mean, I think it's complicated. The tax structure, you know, since Prop 13 has been out of whack. But that, to me, is the heart of the problem.
Okay.
You know, you really got to address who's being taxed.
Right.
You have very wealthy corporations and individuals in California that are really not paying their fair share.
Is it good if we have like an Apple or a Google all of a sudden come into partnership with the universities? Do we run the risk of having it become too corporatized versus maybe me going to school? Like when I went to Cal, I started out as an engineer, you know, for 3 years and got there and was like, this isn't for me, and went into another thing. You can never do that now, you know.
Right.
It would be too expensive, one, and two, you know, they try to put caps in.
Right.
Like, you pick a path, stick with it, and that's the end of it. You know, we don't want you here too much.
Sure.
But with that in mind, it's kind of like, are we just putting people on a treadmill so that they become the farm team for these big corporations who aren't even paying their fair share?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we live in a capitalist country, so I think to some degree there will be corporate involvement in schools. The question is, who's driving the partnership? Is it being driven by the educators and the values of ensuring that children receive a good, sound education, or is it being driven by the corporate interest, which tend to be about profiteering? And as long as it's driven by the educators, I'm less suspicious of it.
Right.
The truth is, right now, schools are desperate. They're desperate for resources. So they're trying to find ways to bring extra resources in to meet the needs of their students.
But does it come with hamstrings like the
they always do.
Well, you know, like the research that you did, you know, could you honestly do that research now in an environment where it might be a charter school that's gone? we'll fund research, you know, might be one of these profiteers that come along saying, we'll do the research. Could you really do what you did, you know, right, that have established you in a position that you are in 2013?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. If you're getting money from corporations, it does often come with strings attached. I've been lucky over the years that I've been able to get money from to support research from foundations, from government, other sources that are not about, you know, trying to direct and control the direction. But I think that that is a real issue in the university is the way in which private interest end up driving the educational agenda.
You know, now let's go back to what we were saying. You gave me two, building community and literacy, if you were the superintendent or the secretary of education. What are the other two?
Well, you really got to work with parents. Parents, they have to be partnerships with parents. Parents, if you think about it, when you go into an affluent community and you ask the schools, who are you accountable to? They will always say, we're accountable to the parents we serve.
Okay.
And that's because the parents they serve feel entitled. They scrutinize what's going on. They are engaged. And if the schools are not responsive to their needs, they let them know.
Right.
And they raise some hell. When you go to an inner city school or in a rural community that's poor and you ask the educators, who are you accountable to? They will almost never say the parents. They'll say the superintendent, the board of education, some higher authority. And what does that tell you? It tells you that the needs of those parents are not their priority. And if the parents' needs are not a priority, then the children's needs won't be a priority.
No,
so you need schools that are responsive to, but at the same time, that responsiveness is a two-way street.
Right.
Parents also have to be responsible for what their role in supporting their children and getting their kids to school. And
when parents are in survival mode and, you know, and they're working dead-end jobs and two and three jobs, come home at 6 o'clock, nobody wants to go to the PTA meeting. You know, nobody wants to do that sort of stuff. Is there another way in which parents can now start to be involved that reflects the reality that they're facing?
Well, the most important parental involvement is what parents do at home. You know, do they make sure the child gets to bed on time? Do they read to the child at night? Do they check the homework?
Right.
Do they get the child up in the morning on time for school?
Right.
If parents are doing those things and reinforcing the importance of education, even if they can't get to school to see the teacher, they are a partner in the process. And then the school has to figure out ways to communicate with that parent. It's not just about being at president of the school, because you're right. Many parents have lives that don't allow them to get to school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and meet with the teacher.
Right. Well, you know, we need to give a checklist for parents. You know, like if we're here, like if your kid is in whatever school, do you know all his teachers? If you can't name off the teachers, you would agree that's a red flag.
Yeah.
Right? When's the last time you've seen your kid's homework? Have you helped them with their homework? That would be a red flag. What else would be a red flag that parents need to definitely...
Do they know how to reach that teacher if something is coming up? It shouldn't be that you hear after a child has failed.
Right.
You know, you should already know if there's trouble, if he's not doing his homework or something acting on his
class. So they need an email address, they need a phone number or some sort of...
Regular communication.
Okay. And what would be one other thing?
I would say that they want to have a sense of what that child is learning, to know that that the quality is there. You know, many parents would likely to send their child to school and say, good luck, have a good day. But the truth is, if you are not looking at what's going on and making sure that your child is receiving a quality education, sometimes they will slip through the cracks. So they really need to be attentive to the quality of instruction they receive and the overall atmosphere at that school.
In the age of technology, iPads, iPhones, computers, all that sort of stuff, is that a good thing, especially if it's in the classroom, or is it something that is made that is shortchanged folks because they don't know how to do research? Like my kids don't know how to go to a library. They don't know how to do all that. If it ain't on Google, you know, God help you, you know?
Well, I mean, the good news is that, you know, you don't really have to go to the library these days if you know how to do searches on the web. So I'm not against technology, but technology is a tool.
Right.
It's not a solution or a panacea. And if teachers have to be trained on how to use it, students have to be trained on how to use it. And you have to make sure they're using it properly so that it's not, they're not copying things, but they're really, they're driving the technology. They're asking the questions and they're probing the issues themselves. So technology will never replace a teacher.
Can enhance
learning for
children. That would have to be a training that teachers bring to the classroom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you think about it, you know, so many kids are bringing these smartphones to school and the schools are taking them because they're afraid of what the kids will do with them. Smartphone is a tool and a resource. The teachers need to be as adept at using those resources As his students are.
And, you know, just simple things. Like, it was just recently that somebody showed me, like, there were all these libraries that you could find online. You know, it's not on Google, but it's in the actual, you know, the whole other section.
You have access to the Library of Congress, the largest collections in the world online. So, you know, going back to our days, when we only had what was available in walking distance, it's a whole new world now for kids.
Well, there you go. And so our last thing, what do you do, you know?
What do we do about your last change? The last change, I would put a lot of emphasis on leadership. You know, you never find a successful school without a successful and effective principal in place. Hmm. And, you know, we sometimes have this idea that the effective principal is like the Joe Clark from Lean on Me with the walking through the hallways with a baseball bat, authoritative figure. No, the real leaders are visionaries. They know how to bring the best out of people they work with. They know how to create a sense of team and camaraderie among their staff. They know how to engage parents. They know how to motivate students. Mm-hmm. You need leaders like that in schools. And what we should be doing is attracting and training people to become school leaders.
Who are some good leaders that we should look towards?
Oh, I could name so many because I spent a lot of time in schools myself all around the country. You have in New York City a woman I work very closely with, Sadie Silver. Sadie is the principal of PS28 in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. 40% of our students are homeless, but her school is a high-performing school.
Okay.
Right. She has built partnerships with hospitals, with clinics, with the YMCA, so that all of her students' needs are being met. Now, she doesn't eliminate poverty, but what she's doing is mitigating the effects of poverty and putting her kids in a safe, nurturing environment, and they're showing that they can achieve when they receive that kind
of
support.
Is this the one that you told Joe Klein to go to?
Yeah, that's the one.
And he went there and came back and didn't have the right information.
No. All he did was talk about the way she was using her data system.
Okay. Who else would be another good leader?
Oh, well, there's Sue Satchowitz is the principal at Brockton High School in Massachusetts, about to retire. But she's been a very successful leader for several years. And again, she's about, you know, 5'2". She's not about trying to intimidate anybody. She is a leader who leads by example, who brings the best out of her teachers, who works with her students. Those are the kinds of people who inspire others to do good work.
Well, there you have it. You know, we could go on and on with Pedro Nogueira. You know, your two books, are those good foundations for people to read?
Yeah, but I've actually got several other books.
What are the other ones?
I did a book last year with Wade Boykin called Creating the Opportunity to Learn.
Okay.
Moving from Research to Practice to Close the Achievement Gap. I'd recommend that one because we really use that book to kind of look at what the research shows is most effective at addressing the needs of all kinds of learners.
Okay.
And how do we make that available to schools? That's one of the problems right now in this country is a lot of what we know about how to educate kids, how to engage kids, is not being available to teachers.
Okay. And what's the name of that book again?
It's called Creating the Opportunity to Learn.
Okay.
Moving from Research to Practice to Close the Achievement Gap.
Okay. Yeah. Because oftentimes when we have research, it's theoretical, but you're bridging it for
That's
us.
Right. That's right.
And what about the other ones?
Well, we did a book last year called Invisible No More, Understand the Disenfranchisement of Latino Males.
Uh-huh.
I'd done the book on black boys a few years before.
Right.
We wanted to focus on Latino males because Latino males are an underserved population that face many of the same challenges as black males do.
Right. Is there a big difference between what you covered in black boys with the Latino males, other than language maybe?
Yeah. We took a different approach because we looked not just at education. We looked at the criminal justice system. We looked at what was happening in employment and also what was happening in the health system because we wanted to understand in a more broad way why it was that so many Latino males are dropping out of school, are in dead-end jobs. So you think about most of the restaurants and hotels or construction sites, those are Latino males doing that labor, but they're stuck in the low-wage positions, becoming almost a permanent underclass in the society. And a lot of that is about lack of education. It's also about their undocumented status in some cases and operating in the shadows.
But that also speaks to leadership, too.
That's right.
It seems like if leadership, you know, to me, when I talk to my students, I talk to them about not getting a job, but starting their own, you know, business.
Yeah.
That's what I think, you know, that would be leadership.
Sure.
You know, like, you could do this, but also that. But I think if we just kind of not show them that there are other opportunities and lay that on the table, that becomes, you know, you would be stuck in a dead-end job. Yeah, Julio? keep working at the restaurant. That's what you do.
That's right.
And not assume that he knows how to even model himself.
That's right.
To become a boss or to move on.
That's so. Right. Open his own restaurant. No, mm-hmm. I think it's very true. And we have to give kids, that's really why it all comes back to education. We have to give kids not simply marketable skills to get a job, but we have to give them the mindset to be able to control their lives.
Right.
So that they can live as responsible adults who are able to, because the fact is that the way this economy works, people are going to lose jobs.
Yeah.
They're you're going to have to change jobs several times over the course of your adulthood. So the people who do fare best are the people who know how to continue to learn,
right.
how to adapt to changing circumstances, and who are able to use their critical thinking and problem-solving skills to figure out new ways to support themselves and their families.
And my last question for you, Pedro, as we let you go. The role of culture, music, you know, we come up in the hip-hop generation. There's a lot of talk around how to flip that. The arts, which many times had been moved out of schools and is the first to go when there's budget cuts. How important is that for the education system?
It's critical. I mean, kids respond so well to music, to art, and both the popular culture, but even old songs. I mean, I work with a school. This was a failing school out in Canarsie, Brooklyn. And is now a turnaround school, a school that's doing extremely well.
Right.
Every morning, they meet together in the auditorium for an assembly, mm-hmm. and they sing. And I asked the principal, I said, you start the day every day like this? She said, every day.
Wow.
I said, why? She said, I want the kids to feel good about being here. Kids love to sing.
So
think
what, do you
about
have,
this.
What do you have them singing?
They have them singing all kinds of songs. Oh, happy day, all kinds of things.
Not no 2 Chainz song, is it?
But
birthday
what's
song by 2 Chainz.
Think about this. In the old days, in the up until the 1960s, it was common for every kindergarten teacher to have a piano in the classroom.
Mm.
And to know how to play the piano. Because
wow.
we knew back then that music was a foundation for learning. Today, the pianos are gone, music is cut,
right.
Or treated as an elective. And meanwhile, our kids, I meet kids who have memorized the lyrics to hundreds of songs. You know
right.
kids like that, too.
Right.
What does that tell you about their capacity to retain information?
Right.
What we need to do is figure out, how do we use music and the arts to as a bridge to learning in other areas like
right.
science and history?
Well, so that's our kids the whole basis of Sesame Street. And Electric Company and
was,
all those
it
things.
It was, that's true.
With those songs, you
that's
know,
right.
then Schoolhouse Rock was the graduation of
that's
that.
Right.
But we moved away from that.
Yeah. There are people who do innovative work with that, including with hip-hop now.
Right.
But it's still on the margins, not in the mainstream.
Well, there you have. Pedro Nogueira, we appreciate it. How do we get a hold of you? You have a website? Can we?
Yeah, I'm at NYU. You can look me up at New York University. We have a director center there, the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education.
Okay.
We work with schools throughout the country. And you can check out the website and get some more information.
And that's where we can find your books and all that.
Absolutely.
Well, there you have it. Folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
This is the place. And you say... come from far, far, far away. To find their dreams. Chasing down these meteors and comets. Called dreams in the sky of life. Chasing, chasing, chasing down. Chasing, chasing. There's certain hot spots where these meteors and stars have a tendency to fall. And legend has it that California is one of those spots. I believe that to be true. They say this is the place stars are born. They say this is the place legends are made. They say this is the place where angels congregate.